From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on March 13th, 2013, the second day of the papal conclave that followed the resignation of Pope Benedict. Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina was selected to be the next pope, and he chose the name Francis. It did not take long for Pope Francis to turn the church in a direction that has been described as more inclusive and socially progressive. Those themes were reflected when Pope Francis visited the United States, giving praise to historical figures like Dorothy Day and Thomas Merton. And Francis has continued to call for inclusion in many ways, not the least of which involves refugees around the world. So what is the state of the Catholic Church? And more broadly, what's the state of Christianity today? The Christian writer Rod Dreher recently published a new book declaring that Christians have lost the culture wars and should retreat into tight-knit communities, more off the grid, focusing on each other. My guest is a man who can speak to all of this and much more. Father Thomas Rozica is a Rochester native who was called to lead World Youth Day in Toronto, you remember, with Pope John Paul II. Back in 2002, I believe. He also worked as a media attaché for Pope Francis, providing English language translation. He is simply one of the most well-connected Catholic leaders in the world today, I think it's fair to say. And he's back in Rochester for a few days, leading a retreat at St. Joseph's Church in Penfield. But first, he is my guest on Connections, and we're honored to have Father Thomas Rozica, the CEO of Salt and Light Catholic Media and a priest of the Congregation of St. Basil. It's great to have you, Father. Thank you.
What a great honor and privilege to be here with you.
Well, your hometown, right? Still familiar with your home digs here?
Still a little bit changed downtown. There's not a lot of downtown left, but I have to say at the beginning that WXXI was my favorite radio station growing up, classical music. I was even a volunteer here for a couple years when you were very small. And to see this facility now and how much you've expanded in different radio stations, cultural life is alive in Rochester.
We're in the middle of a membership drive, and we called in Father Rozica to help.
This is not a paid service announcement.
No, it's not a paid service.
But I love public radio, and I love what you're doing here.
How often do you get a chance to come back home?
Not very often, once or twice a year. My mom is here, and some of my brothers and sisters, so I visited them. My mom's at St. Anne's home, so I'll spend some time with her each day. My life is based in Toronto, and there's quite a bit of traveling associated with it, but Rochester's still home.
And you grew up and went to school here. Tell us just a little bit about your schooling and background here.
I grew up in East Irondequoit, St. Ambrose Parish. At the time, it was called St. Ambrose. Now it's a different reality, Peace of Christ Parish. Mm-hmm. I went to Nazareth Hall. It was a military school. And then I went to St. Ambrose for grade 8. I went to Aquinas High School. That's where I got hooked with the Bazillion Fathers. And then to St. John Fisher College. I left Rochester in 1980, and my life took me in all kinds of different directions. I wanted to be a high school French and Italian teacher. the French and Italian was there, but somebody had other ideas for what I'd be doing.
And so if you could, you know, we have so much to talk about, I think, with this remarkable pope now and the direction he has taken the church. And I'm very keen to get your insight into whether, you know, some of the media proclamations are accurate, that this pope has turned the church in a more socially progressive direction. Is that doctrine, or is this just, you know, there's a lot of conversation. But before we get there, let's talk a little bit more about your history. You know, because you end up in World Youth Day. Was it 2002? Did I have that right?
2002,
in Toronto,
yes.
How did you end up in the position of leading World Youth Day?
A lady asked me a couple months ago, when I was a little boy, did I dream of leading a World Youth Day? And I said, ma'am, that would be a massive nightmare. Sort of like running the Olympics without money. I was university chaplain at the University of Toronto, a Catholic chaplain, minding my business, and the bishops of Canada came to me in 1999 and asked me what I thought of World Youth Days. I said, these are great events for evangelization, a great outreach. And I said, why are you asking? They said, well, we're looking for a CEO for World Youth Day in Canada. And my response was, and they remind me of this, I said, I pray for that poor guy who's going to get that job. He's got to be a military general with nerves of steel and promise him a name change at the end. And then
you never thought it could be you.
No. 6 months later, I'm sitting in the hot seat for an interview. There was a whole bunch of people interviewed. And then I was told that the job is yours if you want it. So that was really, it changed my life around. I left the university, left teaching, and it was a 4-year endeavor. Preparation, the event itself, and then the cleanup from the event. You're mopping up, cleaning up, paying the bills. And little did I know that afterwards I'd be asked to build on World Youth Day and start the Catholic Television Network for Canada. So that's how it all came about. I kind of look back and say God's got a great sense of humor, because I'm not an event planner. I'm not a television mogul, media mogul or whatever, and I've had to learn a whole new vocabulary.
Now, remind us, what was the attendance of World Youth Day?
World Youth Days have large attendance. So we had different groups, different groupings of people. The final mass was about 850,000 people, Downsview Park. And then we had several events during the week. The papal arrival ceremony was 350,000. The Stations of the Cross, which left a deep and lasting memory. Many Rochester kids were there. We had 600,000. We had 700,000 at the vigil on Saturday night. In other words, we had our hands full. And it went off without a hitch. It was an incredible event taking place against the backdrop of some terrible things in the world. Halfway through the preparations, we had September the 11th, which really shook us to the core. And then we had the major problems of the church, the abuse scandal in Boston in 2002. We had the precarious health of the Pope. But through it all, we knew that this had to happen. And what ended up happening is the World Youth Day in Canada, the last World Youth Day of John Paul II, became a real school of hope, of justice, of peace, and fraternity in a world that was coming undone. And it's left a deep and lasting impression on all of us.
I want to ask a question about why certain leaders connect, especially with youth. I was going to say kids, but young adults as well.
Yeah.
As we saw Pope John Paul II do very well, in my own estimation, and maybe you'll push back a little, Pope Benedict struggled to do, and as Pope Francis does beautifully. Yeah. You know, for example, I was at a baptism on Sunday, and there were two church leaders, the two fathers who are helping lead the services. One, you know, a little on the colder side, and the other so dynamic, and you know, that everyone was just lit up. And that's just personality. I mean, sometimes it's difficult to change personality, and I don't want to be overly critical of that, but I do want to ask you if what you think made Pope John Paul II so electric on World Youth Day, for example, why Pope Francis has been so successful, and do you agree with me that Pope Benedict struggled more in that way?
Oh, absolutely. Each of us brings to ministry our baggage. We bring our past. We bring our formation. John Paul II arrived at the See of Peter in 1978. He had my age. I'm 58. John Paul arrived as 58 years old, an athlete, a swimmer, a mountain climber, a robust figure. And in the beginning, he captivated and electrified the world. Every place he went, he was the center stage. The world moved with him. And then what happened is we saw his health condition. We saw him literally failing and dying before our eyes. And a lot of people said, well, he's going to lose the touch. But he defied everyone by showing that being a hero for people is not attached to being young and agile. The weaker he got, the stronger his message became. And I was with John Paul many times in the years leading up to the World Youth Day. I think I met with him 12 times before World Youth Day. Many times I brought the members of my staff. I had 400 people on staff. 300 were young adults. And I would bring them in groups, and I watched the response that he had to them and their response to him. And I realized this has nothing to do with age, agility, beauty, running around. It's got everything to do with credibility. John Paul II held the bar high. And I think young people today are looking for heroes. The world offers some pretty raunchy heroes to young people today. In the sports world, millions of dollars for these trades of sports heroes. In Hollywood, rise today and fall tomorrow. These are not the heroes we should offer people. And what we're doing with the church and what John Paul II has done is to offer authentic heroes. And one of them was himself. He didn't present himself as a hero, but he was somebody who overcame all kinds of challenges, lost his parents at a young age. He lived through the horrors of the Second World War, watched his Jewish friends rounded up and taken away and perished in the Holocaust. He struggled against communism. He was a warrior, he was a bold person, and young people found in him somebody they can imitate. I always say that he was the grandfather that many young people didn't have or don't know. Benedict comes along, and Benedict, one of the greatest theologians of the church. I loved Benedict. But Benedict comes with a Germanic background. He was not a residential pastor for a long time. He was in Munich just for a few years, but his job was an office job. He was the guardian of the faith, the watchdog of the faith. And, you know, people have all of these false words they use from the Panzer Kardinal and Rottweiler, and that nothing could ever be wrong as those titles were. This was a timid, wonderful, humble, holy, gentle man, almost receding when you met him. But he didn't have that touch of John Paul II. Benedict didn't study acting as John Paul II did. Benedict wasn't a Latino. And when you're dealing with German people, it's a bit stiff, if you will. But once you get to know German people, I lived in Germany and studied in Germany, and once you get to know them, there's a wonderful warmth. but they're not exactly Latinos, huggy, kissy, loving, embracing, abrazos, you know, with the Hispanic culture. Pope Francis comes along, and he's a residential pastor. For example, I remember Benedict at the World Youth Day in Cologne. Benedict's elected in 2005, in April, and he's in Cologne, Germany, his homeland, several months later for his first World Youth Day. And those of us who were working up close with him kind of smiled because there was a little bit of stiffness. I remember somebody running up to him at one point. He was on the hill at Marienfeld, the big gathering like Downsview Park. And Benedict just stood there, and somebody ran over and said, "Lift your arms." And he raised his arms, and the crowd went, "Ah!" You know, but he learned that, and Benedict had a message that young people listened to. Francis comes along, and having been with Francis in Rio de Janeiro for the World Youth Day shortly after his election, it was electrifying to see him. But he had been a residential pastor. He had been archbishop of one of the largest dioceses in the world, and he brings with him his Latino baggage, all of the good stuff. And, you know, people have often asked me, what's your first response when you're with the Pope? Because I've been with him several times. I was with him a couple weeks ago. I said, your first response is you have this insatiable urge to hug him. But before you do that, he hugs you. And there's a gentleness, there's a humor, there's a practicality, and there's a softness and a tenderness in him. And I think that's why the world has responded as they have.
You know, you probably can't fake humility. And you look at Pope Francis, he gravitates toward the people who need the help the most. Even when he's in a sea of people, he holds up the poor. He finds the people who are in need, the sick. And he breaks some of what probably his handlers would like him to do.
Oh, he causes... some angst.
Some real headaches.
I say that he's got a homing device that when there is a handicapped person, a poor person, a person who's, you know, an underdog, he zooms in, jumps off the Pope mobile. I know the chief of security. I know the chief of police at the Vatican. I know the Swiss guards. And I always say, how are you doing? And they sign themselves with the cross. He's prudent, there's no question. And he's become more prudent because of the world we're living in. But he is complete. The thing that I admire the most is Francis is completely free. And that's quite a great gift to be free.
Well, and listeners, if you want to weigh in with your thoughts and comments on Pope Francis or the state of the Catholic Church today, we have a lot to discuss with Father Thomas Rosica, the CEO of Salt and Light Catholic Media and a priest of the Congregation of St. Basil, a Rochester native who is back in town. Remind our listeners why you're back home this week.
I was invited by Father Jim Schwartz and his outstanding pastoral team at St. Joseph's Church in Penfield to lead the resurrection retreat. And let me tell you, I've been to a lot of parishes. I come from a wonderful parish myself. But St. Joseph's in Penfield is a hopping place. This is a vibrant parish community. It's everything that Francis says about what a parish community is. It's alive. There's 400 or 500 people in church for the mission each evening for the retreat. The weekend masses were astounding. I teased Father Jim on Sunday at one of the masses. There were baptisms, confirmations, first communions. I said, you should have had a wedding, too. We got to complete this. The parish is alive. It's young. It represents the best of what the church is about.
I want to ask you as well, in a moment, I'm going to read from one of your recent blog posts, because you do plenty of writing and give us a lot of interesting things to think about online, Father Rosica, and I've been mining your material here. Before I get there, you know, I think when I look at Pope Francis, if you actually read, if you read the teachings of Jesus, not just the men who followed Jesus, both in life and in the decades and centuries that followed, who wrote scripture about his message, but if you actually really try to study what Jesus was about, you get the sense that he is much closer to where Pope Francis is. That if Jesus were alive today, whether you believe he was the Son of God or not, he would probably be doing what Pope Francis is doing, seeking out poor people in need, helping them. And I wonder if you think the reason that this Pope is really connecting with young people is that there is this surge of awareness in the young generation, this social responsibility, and that this Pope looks like he's much more quote-unquote Christian in the way that Jesus probably was. Do you agree with that?
I think what we see with Pope Francis, a lot of people say, well, he's South American, he's from Buenos Aires, he's a Jesuit, or whatever. I always say, no, Pope Francis comes from Galilee. The message that he's offering us is simply the message of the gospel. He's teaching us the gospel. He's bringing the gospel alive. He's not the scripture scholar. He didn't have to do all that stuff that I had to do in scripture scholarship. He did other things. but he knows what the meaning of the gospel is. He's a profoundly prayerful man. His life is rooted in the scriptures. Being a Jesuit has certainly helped. His language, his Jesuitical language, the language of discernment, of an accompaniment, he knows who he is, and he knows what the gospel's about. His daily homilies, this morning's homily, for example, I have to distribute the homilies he gives every morning to 1,500 journalists, 1,600 journalists. And the homilies go right to the core of the gospel. He is about evangelization, which is proclaiming the good news. This does not mean he's not aware of all the problems in the world, but what is the antidote to violence? What's the antidote to ignorance? What's the antidote to indifference? The antidote is the gospel, and he's showing us how to do that simply, clearly, and profoundly.
Do you get the sense that that this pope is, I don't want to say more concerned about the poor than maybe his predecessor, or but do you think that the label that, that much of the American media at least have given him, which is more of a social progressive, more interested in those kinds of causes, is that fair?
I don't think it's accurate. I'm not saying it's not fair. I don't think it's accurate because if we look at the pontificate, the ministry of John Paul II, we didn't have social media at the time of John Paul II, and social media started to rise under Benedict. But John Paul II was labeled as, you know, the left-wing pope in the beginning. John Paul II came from the world of communism. He stood up to the, he spoke truth to power. The fall of communism, no matter what you are or where you are in the spectrum, John Paul II had a hand in all of that. He spoke often about Solidarnosc in the beginning. He was criticized for that. What are you bringing all that stuff to us? There was a deep social consciousness. The social teachings under John Paul II, the major encyclicals, Labor Mexercens, Solici Todo Re Socialis, he addressed social concerns. Pope Benedict comes along, and he was deeply concerned, but he provided the theological foundations. For example, one of the encyclicals of Pope Benedict, Caritas in Veritate, Charity in Truth, an extraordinary document where he brought together the two streams, if you will, of social justice, theology, and the pro-life stream. And the Green Pope, even though Francis is getting a lot of credit right now, the Green Pope was Pope Benedict. Germans are big into being green. Benedict put the solar panels on. Benedict reflected on all of this, and Francis comes along and builds on all of that with his marvelous encyclical letter, Laudato Si. So to say that Francis is more socially concerned, I think the better way to say it would be Pope John Paul II kept alive the social teachings of the church from Leo XIII onward. He wrote encyclicals. He taught us. He came from the background of oppression. Pope Benedict not only wrote about it, he gave us a foundational theology, and Pope Francis is showing us how to practice it very practically because he comes from the third world. Neither John Paul II nor Benedict XVI had a third world experience. We have a pope now who comes from the bottom of the world, or the end of the world, as he says in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and he was living in a world of great contrasts. He brings those gifts to the papacy, and he's showing us, this is what my predecessors did. This is what Leo XIII did. This is what John Paul II taught. This is what Benedict gave us in those beautiful documents. Now I'm going to show you how to put this in practice.
All right. So, Father, this is where I know you and I will disagree then, because it's more interesting if we disagree on something then.
Sure. I hope so.
With Benedict, the narrative then, what you're telling us is some of the narrative about Benedict is unfair or misunderstands the man, that he wasn't necessarily cold or, you know, not interested in inclusion, prickly, more closed off, a smaller, more devoted church was more interested in, as opposed to bringing in more voices. You're saying we misunderstand the man if that's the only narrative we have. My response to you, because what you tell us, he was a brilliant theologian. He was more technical. He was a writer. He was a scholar in ways that Francis is not, but he had different gifts. So my response to that would be, well, he should have stayed a cardinal then, because as a pope, you have a responsibility that Francis is carrying out in ways that that pope did not, and that his better role was as a cardinal and not as a pope.
I think one of the first qualities of a pope, someone elected to that, should be that they never sought the job. John Paul II never sought the job. Benedict never wanted it.
Ratzinger wanted that job.
Come on. Oh, no.
No?
No, I can guarantee you.
See, that's another narrative that's out there, that he was very good at maneuvering for the job.
Narratives need to be shot. I can guarantee you.
Okay.
This was a man at 78 years old who was looking forward to his retirement. He wanted to go back to Germany, play piano with his brother, and write books. And then he was thrust into this job. And I look back now over history, having been there through the whole transition of John Paul II to Benedict, and then from Benedict to Francis, and watching how those things happened. Who could have been the candidate? Who would have been the candidate? The closest advisor to John Paul II. The church was in a very precarious state at that moment. After a 27-year run, if you will, of a pontificate, John Paul II. Remember the funeral of John Paul II, the greatest television moment in history. The world mourned over all of that. This is a great world figure. And Benedict comes along, someone to keep, he knew he wasn't going to be there a long time, but look at the significant things that Benedict did. One of the first things, within weeks, is to open up the whole abuse question, to say, we cannot put this under the carpet, sweep it under the carpet, this must be addressed. Number two, the reforms that Francis is being credited for right now began, little by little, the financial reform, the other reform. My regret for Pope Benedict is this. He was very poorly served by the people who were with him. He trusted people that he had known for a long time, and sometimes that's not necessarily the best thing. And he was really, he deserved much better. The greatest thing that Benedict did was the humility of stepping down. I mean, this greatest figure, only Benedict could have pulled something off like that. The humility that he showed that I am not capable of leading this forward. Someone else must come. And now to see Benedict and to witness his role, it's the sweet surrender of humility and strength. And he's there, and there's a great relationship between him and between Francis. Contrary to what the media people are saying, that they're at odds with each other, Benedict, he's there in the Vatican Gardens, living in the convent. He's a man of prayer, and his works continue to speak.
And so Father Rozica is here helping us set the narrative straight on some of what he sees as the current state of the Catholic Church. Certainly, when you look at Christianity worldwide, it's a big tent. But I do look at Francis, and then I see some ostensible Christianity in the Joel Osteens of the world, the prosperity gospel, the God wants you to be rich. God would like you to drive a Ferrari. And I can't imagine Pope Francis ever saying that. Does that come off as crude to you? Again, I know that's outside the Catholic tent. Does that come off as crude to you?
No, Francis doesn't do Ferraris. He does Ford Focus or Kia Souls or, yes, or little black cars when he's in the United States. No, Francis is challenging the status quo. He's reminding people that we are not what we own. We are not a prosperity gospel. This is a gospel of selfless service. It's a gospel of generosity. And he's really shaken people up around the world. But he's not doing this as a photo opportunity. This is what he's always done. This is who he is. And therefore, he's offering us an example. And after all, he's basing his life and his ministry on Jesus.
When we come back from our early break of the hour, we are going to read some of Father Rozica's latest blog post about what it means to be pro-life and why pro-life is an important term, but it can lead to some tunnel vision for some people in the movement, and why he thinks it needs to get beyond abortion. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the refugee crisis. You might have seen Father Rozica with George Stephanopoulos on ABC News not too long ago. It was a conversation about the true meaning of Christmas, and he also had some things to say about not only what Father Rozica, but also Pope Francis might have to say about refugees and the current state of how we fear people and how we cast people out who truly need help. So we'll talk a little bit about that and a lot more. And if you have anything you want to add to the conversation, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Coming up in our second hour, Democrat and Chronicle reporter Gary Craig joins us to talk about his new book, 7 Million. It's all about the Rochester Brinks heist from January 1993 that is still essentially an unsolved case. He ties so many threads together in a gripping tale that reads like a novel, but it is not fiction, it's real life. And this story is at the center of our discussion next hour with Gary Craig. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we grab our first phone call, let me go ahead and follow up and read what Father Rozica had to say in his latest blog post about what pro-life means. And Father, you write the following, quote, "Abortion is without a doubt the most serious wound inflicted not only on individuals and their families, who should provide the sanctuary for life, but inflicted as well on society and its culture by the very people who ought to be society's promoters and defenders. We must never lose sight of the atrocities against the unborn. However, a singular focus on abortion as the arbiter of what it means to be pro-life has severely narrowed our national discourse about moral values in the public square. People claiming to be fervently Catholic, always right, and blinded by their own zeal and goodness have ended up defeating the very cause for which we must all defend with every ounce of energy in our flesh and bones. Their anger vitiates their efforts. Could it be that some of us are turned off or even repelled by current definitions or behaviors of some of those people claiming to be pro-life, yet manifesting a tunnel vision? The Roman Catholic Church offers a consistent teaching on the inviolability, the sacredness, and the dignity of the human person, a 2020 vision for which we must strive each day if we claim to be pro-life. Opposition to abortion and euthanasia does not excuse indifference to those who suffer from poverty, violence, and injustice. We must strive to see the whole picture, not with tunnel vision, end quote. It was about 3 months or so ago, we had a conversation, Father, on this program with people in the quote, pro-life movement, who some of whom I think you would probably say have a little bit of tunnel vision, others who are much more in the, you know, pro-life means war, it means suffering, it means poverty, it means abortion, it means all of those things. Why did you decide to write this right now?
It was published yesterday, I believe, because in Canada this week we have the so-called March for Life, as there's one in January in Washington every year and in many cities. And this year it's in Canada, in Ottawa and in several cities. And I do that because it's very important that we remember the whole picture. All of us as Christians are pro-life by our baptism. We realize the evil, the atrocity of abortion, but to focus in on that and nothing else, we avoid or we fail to understand what the Roman Catholic Church teaches. We use the expression as Roman Catholics, the consistent ethic of life from womb to tomb, from the earliest moments to the final moments and everything in between. And Pope John Paul II especially, in a very important encyclical letter, Evangelium Vitae, the Gospel of Life, does a wonderful job in saying there's no question that abortion is at the top of the list, but there's a lot of other stuff that comes with it. The care and treatment of the poor, of the handicapped, unjust working conditions, the abuse of women and children, poverty in all of its forms, destitution of people, and then the whole question of euthanasia and end-of-life issues. So for us to have a tunnel vision, we must be focused on the whole thing. And Pope Francis has revived very strongly this idea of the consistent aspect of life. In the United States, there was a great bishop in Chicago years ago, Cardinal Joseph Bernardin, who did his best to offer the seamless garment, the consistent ethic of life, and was shot down by many people saying, no, no, it's only abortion, it's only this. And now what we see Pope Francis doing, and not only Pope Francis, many bishops and leaders around the world to say, there's no question that abortion is wrong. However, we must be concerned about all of these other related issues. And that's why I wrote that, because a lot of us, when we get caught up with something and it becomes an ideology and our zeal takes over, we become blind and we have tunnel vision. We must do everything we can. In Canada right now, we have a terrible thing happening with the imposition of a law, the establishment of a law for end-of-life issues, with all kinds of euphemisms used for killing people. Medically assisted suicide, medically assisted dying. This is a pro-life issue as well.
All right, let me grab our first phone call. And this is Sean in Rochester with Father Thomas Rosica. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Evan.
Sure.
Just wanted to ask your guest today. I come from a Protestant background and currently am in a Protestant tradition. And I wanted to know if there are any avenues of intersection that you see between the Catholic Church and Protestant movements today, and if there's any areas that we might be reconciled on. I think I hear from congregants in my church right now who have come from Catholic backgrounds that say, well, I wasn't in a Christian church before, but now I am. And I just wanted to know if there's any way that we can kind of encourage inclusive talk whenever we speak about our brothers and sisters in the Catholic movement.
Thank you, Sean. Pope Francis has made ecumenism, the ecumenical movement, ecumenical efforts, a real priority for his ministry. And I just look back over the past 4 years, the incredible visits and meetings he's had, not only with leaders of churches, but with congregations of people in churches with whom the Catholic Church may have been at odds at different moments in history. And what Pope Francis is doing in each of those situations, I think particularly, for example, of the primate of the Anglican Church, Archbishop Justin Welby, With Archbishop Welby, the Pope has a very close relationship, and though we may have some doctrinal differences, ordination of women, the who can serve in the church and leadership, what the Pope is doing, what Archbishop Welby's doing, for example, is calling us back to what we can do together. He's done the same with the Lutheran Church recently by going to Sweden and having, this is the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. And there's all kinds of joint efforts and ceremonies and prayers and projects that are being worked on together. The other thing that the Pope has reminded us is, while we may have some doctrinal differences, and that might be the cause of what some of your congregants or friends may be saying, let's look at everything we can do together, and let's look at the leader. You know, people often ask me, who's the head of your church? Especially when Christians ask me, I says, the same one who's the head of your church. It's Jesus Christ. And we have historical things that have happened which have separated different communities. What can we do together, and how can we give a common Christian witness? Because in a world where Christianity is being shoved to the edges, or really people are trying to erase it, and the massive persecution of Christians right now taking place all over the world, we need to be standing together as those who believe in Jesus. You know, today's a good example. In the gospel today, for the daily mass, in the common lectionary, it's at Antioch that people were first called Christians. I just celebrated mass at St. Joe's this morning with a huge group of people. And I reminded them, you know, in the Middle East, where I lived for 5 years, we identified ourselves in the Arab-speaking world, the Arabic-speaking world, and also in the Hebrew world, in Israel. We are the people of the one from Nazareth. Anachnu Notzrim. We are the ones from Nazareth. We're associated with Jesus. And no matter what our divisions may be in terms of institutions, we as Christians, you and I, and many of your friends and my friends, we are of the one from Nazareth.
All right, before I go back to the phones, John, we'll come to you in a moment, but there's a couple of other points I want to make sure we get through with Father Rosica. I mentioned the refugee crisis. You were on with George Stephanopoulos, who was asking you about the meaning of Christmas, and you told him the following, quote, "The world needs peace. This is the worst I've seen the world in my lifetime." And then you referenced the refugee crisis. You said we should not shut our doors to strangers because at one point in our life, we were the wandering refugees seeking a home. And you said that when we shut out refugees, we're motivated by fear. Now, in particular, I don't mean to politicize, but some at this moment, this is a sort of a politicized issue. Some supporters, for example, of Donald Trump would call the program and say, this is naive, that there is a danger here, and that this is politicizing the issue when you make those statements. What do you say to that?
When fear is the motivating principle, when we pass judgment because of catastrophes that have happened with small subsets of particular groups, we are not being faithful to who we are as human beings. When I said to George at that wonderful Christmas program at ABC that all of us were refugees, we're all immigrants. Pope was an immigrant. My family came from Italy. This is a society of immigrants. And the minute we give in to xenophobia, the minute we pass judgments based on a terrorist act by some particular group claiming to be Muslim and they're not even true to Islam, we fail in what we're supposed to do. And the politics of fear must not take over. Political leaders, whether it be the one that's here in this country or other leaders, who are exciting and inciting people to be afraid to build walls and not bridges, are really not helping the cause of humanity. That does not mean we should not be prudent in those people we are inviting into our countries. By no means is this an invitation to be imprudent, but rather it's to say, what can we gain, what can we learn from the people we're welcoming in? Toronto, for example, the Archdiocese of Toronto, where I live, is one of the leading dioceses and cities in the country, in Canada, in their refugee policies. They welcome people in, and I've helped bring in refugees. When I was chaplain of the University of Toronto, I brought in refugees. We sponsored them. It's an enriching situation. But bringing in refugees is not simply a matter of finances. It's not just to provide, it's to accompany people to help integrate them. So we have to be very careful of capitulating to the politics of fear. When the politics of fear help to gain someone public office, we need to question ethics, we need to question foundation, we need to question one's motives.
I don't want to ask you if you think this president or the previous, I have this aversion to this idea of saying, is this person a Christian? Is this person, people can believe many things in their hearts, and it's hard to for me to get inside someone's heart. I will ask you if you think this president's actions are Christian.
I don't want to comment on that because I am an outsider, really. Though I have dual citizenship and I know a little bit about the United States, I don't think it's fair for me to pass judgment. I would only say this. what Pope Francis has described several times when he was asked about political leaders. He said, when political leaders are motivated by fear, when they're not serving the common good, when they incite people, and when they build walls rather than bridges, we need to wonder what they're about. And I think that's the question we need to ask. And we need to let history unfold and let history determine that.
And to follow up on the question of refugees, we recently had a member of Congress, a Republican, John Katko, whose district is the 24th Congressional District of New York, stretches from Syracuse through Wayne County, close to Rochester. He was on this program and talking about not only his own faith, his social conservatism, but also his concern about refugees and what he says we misunderstand when we say the kinds of things that Father, that you've said here. And so let's listen a little bit of what Representative Katko had to say about that. Has there been a single successful attack on this soil from someone who used the refugee process to get in?
Oh, there's been several that, like I just mentioned, one in Bowling Green is an example of
not on the soil
instances.
Here, right?
Well, they tried to. We stopped it. So that shouldn't give you any comfort. Listen, I'm not saying no, and again, I'm not saying we should have a ban. I'm saying we should just make sure properly vet everybody that comes in.
Okay, and does that mean there are going to be parts of Syria, for example, where right now people are just not eligible to come here because, as you said, those territories don't technically exist anymore?
Well, I think it's just basically we can't sit there and say, well, I feel sorry for this person. They got to come, even if we don't know who they are. As long as whatever vetting procedures are set up are followed, I'm okay with it. And that would be the devil, is to try and figure out ones that are proper that you can vet.
He did go on to say that there are parts of Syria where we simply can't take anyone right now. There's just too much uncertainty that we should be concerned, maybe even scared. What would you say?
We have to be prudent. We have to be wise. I believe the vetting procedures that are in place through the international organizations such as Caritas, such as Development and Peace in Canada, the United States Catholic Bishops' efforts, the Red Cross, we have to work together. This is a common joint effort in helping people whose lives have been decimated. Their futures have been taken away from them. Syria is tragic, one of the most beautiful countries in the Middle East, a country of great history, and we see the evil that's perpetrated by those who claim to be part of this new Islamic reality, this Islamic state. And the other interesting thing is to realize that many people claiming to be part of ISIS or Daesh or whatever you call it here are not from the Islamic faith. They've been attracted to this mythical world that they're living in to find their future. And it's the power and the reign of evil that's at work.
All right, let me grab the next phone call. In Rochester, this is John on with Father Rosica. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. Hey, Father. Father, I heard, number one, I've read and I've lived through the Reagan years and Pope John Paul II, and they were quite the item. I guess they were very good friends.
Yes.
And communicated on a regular basis. And the impression I get is that President Reagan and John Paul II were responsible, really, for the breakdown of the Soviet Union. The other thing, I just heard this, author, Dr. Paul Kengor, just finished the book about, I think, John Paul II, and he talked about the assassination attempt on John Paul, and he stated that there was the Russians were behind the assassination attempt, and the U.S. government has information about that. They had it, I think, by 1985, but they kept it under wraps and continued to keep it under wraps to a certain extent. But that information is out there. Were you aware of this, or can you add to this?
Sure, I can say a couple things. First of all, there's no question in my mind that the coalition, if you will, or the collaboration of the Reagan administration and Pope John Paul II and Vatican diplomacy had a hand in what eventually became the Velvet Revolution and the fall of communism, the fall of the Iron Curtain. But to simply say they were the only two involved is not accurate. There was a whole group of people and forces. But we see it in the pictures and in the history books that have come out that they played very key roles. I'm certain that they disagreed on other things, but I know that there was a certain sympathy and respect, a great respect between the two of them. Some of the stuff has become public now, some of it hasn't. Regarding the assassination attempt, it's interesting you bring that up because the anniversary of that is this week on May the 13th. There's a stone in St. Peter's Square. In fact, we're going to be showing a picture of it shortly in our network that commemorates or marks the place where John Paul II was going out in the general audience on the Wednesday and the Ali Agca shot him and expecting him to kill him. And we know what happened there. And then we know later on John Paul II's understanding of that, which is very clearly linked to Our Lady of Fatima. It's interesting you speak about it because this week we know that Pope Francis is flying to Fatima in Portugal on Friday to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the apparitions of Our Lady of Fatima to the three children. And while he's in Fatima, he will canonize the two of the three. Sister Lucia's cause is still open. She was a nun, but the brother and sister, the two children, will be canonized, the visionaries, the ones who saw that. And John Paul II sees a very clear link between Our Lady of Fatima's the secret that was finally revealed in the year 2000, and that the bullet that went through John Paul was shielded and protected and guided by Our Lady's own hand. And that very bullet that the doctors removed is in Fatima in the crown of the statue. So a lot of this comes together. John Paul never gave in to a lot of the political conspiracy theories. He was well aware of it. We still don't understand the whole role of Ali Agca and who was behind him, and was it Bulgaria, was it the Russians or whatever. But the fact is that John Paul II survived and continued his very heroic papacy and is now a saint.
Hmm. What a story. Thank you, John, for the phone call. Barb in Avon is next on the phones. Go ahead, Barb.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I just wanted to say that I had the great luck of going to school with Father Tom at St. John Fisher College. And it's wonderful to hear him speak and just to share his knowledge and his wisdom. And I have to say that he is living the very embodiment of Christianity that he speaks so highly of with Pope Francis and Pope Benedict in their own ways. But he is doing it in his way. And it's so wonderful to see him having taken that forward from his own humble beginnings.
Come to see me sometime in Toronto. I'd love to reminisce and tell Fisher stories.
Oh, we'd have to be careful about what we talked about, though.
Barb, thank you. That's a lovely message.
That's very nice.
You're coming back to WXXI. All your your old classmates and friends are listening.
You excel at WXXI in bringing people together.
That is our goal here. Yeah. Look at this. Thank you, Barb. That's very nice. A couple of comments from listeners on some of what Father Rosica had to say about what being pro-life means. Jill writes to say yes, yes, yes to what Father Rosica is saying. And she follows up to say, what is the church doing to help with poverty, unintended pregnancies, birth control, etc., to help prevent abortion?
Those are very good questions. What's the church doing to help with poverty? An awful lot. I mean, the church is in the vanguard of the institutions and agencies helping. Here in Rochester, how could I speak about the question of the church's response to poverty without mentioning Sister Grace Miller and the House of Mercy downtown? An amazing place. I discovered it last year, and I'll do everything I can. I let the Pope know about the House of Mercy, and Grace's work and the Sisters of Mercy do a tremendous job. What's to say that the church is pro-life and the church is against abortion is not enough. If we are pro-life, if we are pro-humanity, we have to take care of people and provide safety nets for them. So if we want people to keep the child and the young people to keep the child through an unfortunate pregnancy, we have to provide everything they need to bring that child to birth, to support that child. It's not enough simply to rant and rave and march and protest, but we have to create institutions. And birth control is not the response to being pro-life or pro-choice.
Why not?
It's not. The church teaches responsible sexuality, responsible parenthood, the proper place. And I think Pope Francis is very aware of this. And to simply say, oh, the solution to pro-choice, the solution to the abortion crisis is simply to provide condoms or all kinds of medication and drugs, that would be ridiculous. It makes no sense.
But it ignores human behavior for centuries, thousands of years, studied under different conditions. I mean, you're expecting a change in just human DNA.
What we are expecting is adult formation to prepare people about responsible parenthood, responsible sexuality is a tremendous gift. The church is pro-sex. The church is pro-family. But at the same time, to simply say, here's the quick solution, do whatever you want, it's not helping people to live mature relationships.
All right, so real quick, Valerie, because I've got more I want to squeeze in the last 5 minutes or so. Valerie says, I have a friend who had 3 babies die in utero. If abortion had not been allowed, she would have had to wait, which with each of those babies inside of her. How do you think the church would view this personal, painful, almost unimaginable situation?
The church would stand very closely with this person, to support the father, the husband, whoever it is, and to grieve with somebody who's lost 3 babies like that. I've had friends that have had exactly the same thing, and it's a very painful situation. The church never condemns. The church walks with and accompanies and encourages people to believe in life.
Kate in Brighton. Go ahead, Kate.
Hi. It's a complicated question, but maybe we can stick to the simplicity of it. The Pope that we have now, Francis, has been called the People's Pope, and he's brought many people back to the church with his focus, and I emphasize the word focus, on love, mercy, charity, as opposed to the traditional rules of the church and, you know, more of a carrot than a stick philosophy. And I'm wondering if Father Ruzicka sees future papacies recognizing the power of identifying with this message to the average Catholic, and if he thinks that the papacy will kind of loosen up a little and choose more people along the lines of Francis than perhaps some of the more sterner popes of the past.
Thank you, Kate.
Thank you very much. It's a very good question. Of course, I believe very much that the Holy Spirit guides the church. This is not the Vatican guiding the church or a group of cardinals in an upper room. This is the Holy Spirit. We are given the popes for our times. In my lifetime, and you sound young too, so in your lifetime and our lifetimes, we've been given some very good popes. We didn't have the Borgias. We didn't have the scandalous popes. You know, the papacy has not been a really nice institution at different moments in history. But in our lifetimes, we have been very blessed and graced with popes. I believe that the strategic vision and planning of this pope is going to provide an opportunity for those who go into the Sistine Chapel the next time there's an election. It will be a group of cardinals, most of whom would have been appointed by Pope Francis. And they, most of them, almost all of them, are men who are in touch with the reality. And when they gather together under the influence of the Holy Spirit, they will provide the church what the church needs. I have full confidence of that. Pope Francis is not sitting there with a crystal ball saying, who is going to follow me? I'm going to choose the person. Pope Francis is doing what he's been asked to do. I firmly believe that the Lord is with him. He's a very holy man. He's a wonderful human being, and he's choosing some very good cardinals who will form the group that will choose the successor.
Father, by the way, Jill is the one who asked about what the church is doing to help with poverty, unintended pregnancy, birth control. She followed up to say she may not agree with everything she's hearing from you, but, quote, I like this dude. So you just got called a dude. You're a pretty young guy.
I've been called all kinds of stuff, but I don't mind being called a dude. My staff does that.
She's sending a lot of love to you. And I think a lot of people are appreciating what they're hearing. It's a very open dialogue. Father Ruzicka is just about the easiest person I think I've ever talked to as a man of the cloth. So I want to close with this. Later this month, we're going to have a conversation with different Christian leaders around town about Rod Dreher's new book. He's an Orthodox Christian writer, and his new book is called The Benedict Option. He says, to his dismay, Christians have lost the culture wars, and he says it's time to admit that, time to stop obsessing with politics, and to retreat into more off-the-grid communal living, kind of how we see with Orthodox Judaism, those kinds of communities, more focused on each other, a little bit more away from the grid, more inward-looking. What do you make of that?
I've read the book. I've read all the commentaries in the book, and I think that Mr. Dreher, I think you pronounce his name, he needs a prescription for hope. John the 23rd, when he called the Second Vatican Council, gave a magnificent address in 1962 and talked about the prophets of doom and gloom, and they don't really inspire people to action. They cause massive depression. And so I read the book, and some of the points are correct, but the one element that's terribly missing from the book is a politics of hope. Pope Francis is well aware of the messes in the world and in the church, but he is also a man of hope. And if the world needs anything right now, in the midst of the crisis of the world needs hope, not Pollyannish hope, but authentic hope, which finds its roots in the Gospels.
Then 20 seconds, if this is the darkest you've seen the world in your lifetime, what gives you optimism?
Pope Francis and the faith of many, many people around the world, and I've been around the world, and I have to say, the faith and the joy and exuberance of the Parish Community of St. Joseph's in Penfield. If you want a little dose of hope, if any of you are suffering from sadness, go to St. Joe's this weekend.
They're going to ask you to stay, though. They've enjoyed your visit so much,
Father. I
got
to go home.
Father Rosica is the CEO of Salt and Light Catholic Media. Home is in Toronto, but nice to see you back in your home digs in Rochester. Rochester is proud to have you here, so thank you for being here. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
It's been a lovely visit with Father Rosica. Let's get a short break and much more Connections straight ahead.